Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book, The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, Why Some Are So Rich and Some So Poor is a Work of Economic History by David S. Landis that asks a large and enduring question, why do some societies become wealthy while others remain poor, rather than treating development as the result of a single cause? Landis combines history, economics, culture, geography, and institutional analysis to explain long-term differences in national prosperity. The book ranges across Europe, the United States, Japan, China, the Arab world, and Latin America, using comparative evidence to show how paths of growth and stagnation diverge over centuries. Its purpose is not to offer a simple policy formula, but to challenge deterministic explanations that rely only on natural resources or location. Instead, it argues that norms, incentives, political structures, innovation, and attitudes toward work and change all shape economic outcomes. The result is a broad interpretive account of global inequality, written for readers interested in history, development, and the forces behind wealth creation. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, culture as an engine of economic performance. One of the book's central claims is that culture matters deeply in explaining why some societies prosper. Landis gives serious attention to the Weberian idea that Protestant values encouraged habits useful for commerce and industrial growth, such as hard work, punctuality, thrift, enterprise, and free inquiry. He does not argue that religion mechanically determines outcomes, but that shared norms can support patterns of behavior that make markets function better and innovation more likely. In this framework, culture shaped whether people value time, trust contracts, invest in skills, and accept change. Landis uses this lens to compare regions of Europe and to suggest that northern Protestant societies often developed stronger commercial and industrial advantage than their southern Catholic counterparts. The argument is broader than religion alone because it concerns the deeper moral and social habits a society rewards. This makes culture a practical economic force, not just a background condition. At the same time, the book invites debate by implying that values can help explain persistent differences that pure materialist theories leave out. Secondly, institutions, competition, and the conditions for innovation. Landis places strong emphasis on institutions because wealth depends on more than talent or resources. Political competition, relative freedom, and market-oriented exchange create environments in which new ideas can survive and spread. The book argues that when rulers face constraints, when merchants can operate with some security, and when property and trade are protected, societies are more likely to convert knowledge into productivity. This helps explain why parts of Western Europe advanced earlier than many other regions, not because they were naturally superior, but because their institutional setting rewarded experimentation and enterprise. Landis also connects institutional openness to the broader history of technological advance, showing that innovation is not just a matter of invention, but of adoption, diffusion, and commercial use. This is an important distinction because many societies have produced clever ideas without building systems that consistently turn them into growth. By focusing on institutions, the book bridges political history and economic development. It suggests that good policy is not only about investment levels, but about the rules, incentives, and freedoms that make sustained innovation possible. Thirdly, why technology and know-how mattered more than raw resources. A recurring theme in the book is that small technological advantages can generate large historical consequences. Landis highlights inventions and practical know-how as major drivers of Western economic expansion, including seemingly modest tools such as eyeglasses and clocks. His point is that prosperity often comes from cumulative improvements in measurement, coordination, transport, manufacturing, and military capacity. These advances increase productivity and allow societies to organize labor and capital more effectively. The book therefore resists explanations that rely only on abundant land, minerals, or climate. Wealth emerges from the ability to learn, adapt, and apply knowledge in useful ways. Landis treats technology not as an isolated invention story, but as part of a larger social system that includes education, craftsmanship, discipline, and market demand. This perspective helps explain why some regions with fewer natural advantages outperformed others that had richer endowments. It also shows why economic development is difficult to reduce to one factor. Technology requires supporting institutions and attitudes. In Landis's account, the real divide between rich and poor nations is often the divide between societies that repeatedly turn knowledge into usable improvement and those that do not. Fourthly, a global historical comparison of Europe, Asia, the Arab world, and Latin America. The book is distinguished by its wide comparative scope. Landis does not confine himself to one country or era, but places Europe, the United States, Japan, China, the Arab world, and Latin America into a single interpretive framework. This method allows him to examine why industrialization accelerated in some places and stalled in others over long stretches of history. The comparison is important because it prevents readers from treating European success as inevitable or universal. Instead, it becomes one historical pathway among several, shaped by distinct social and political choices. Landis also pushes back against claims that Asian growth was insignificant or merely an artifact of Western influence. He recognizes the dynamism of Asian economies while still arguing that development must be understood historically, not as a simple race between civilizations. The strength of this approach is its breadth. It links regional histories to recurring patterns of adaptation, decline, and reinvention. At the same time, the method demands caution because such a large canvas can encourage strong generalizations. Even so, the book's comparative ambition is one of its defining features and helps explain why it remains widely discussed. Lastly, critique, controversy, and the book's Eurocentric reputation. The Wealth and Poverty of Nations is influential partly because it is unapologetically argumentative. Landis openly embraces a Eurocentric framework, claiming that the historical economic miracle began in Europe and therefore requires a Europe-centered explanation. That stance has made the book controversial, especially among readers who prefer accounts that place more weight on colonialism, global inequality, or non-European contributions. Critics have also questioned the strong emphasis on Protestant values and the risks of making culture appear too deterministic. Yet the controversy is part of the book's significance because it forces readers to confront difficult questions about agency, institutions, and the roots of development. Landis does not present a neutral catalog of causes. He offers a broad interpretive thesis and defends it with historical examples. The result is a book that is as much a challenge to prevailing explanations as it is a synthesis of scholarship. Readers may disagree with its conclusions, but they are likely to find the argument intellectually serious and historically ambitious. Its willingness to state a clear position is one reason it stands apart from more cautious works on development. In conclusion, this book is best suited to readers who want a serious, historically grounded explanation of global inequality rather than a short policy guide. Economists, historians, development specialists, students of international affairs, and general readers interested in why nations diverge will all find it useful. Its main value lies in the way it combines long-range historical comparison with an argument about culture, institutions, and technology. That combination gives readers a broader framework for thinking about development than books that focus only on geography, colonialism, or modern growth policy. It also stands out because it is openly interpretive. Landis does not hide his assumptions or soften his conclusions, which makes the book especially useful for debate and critical reading. Even readers who reject parts of its thesis can benefit from the scope of the evidence and the clarity of the historical questions it raises. Compared with many books in economic history, it is less technical, more synthetic, and more willing to ask large civilizational questions. For that reason, it remains a distinctive and influential study of how wealth is created and why poverty persists. If you would like to support David S. Landis, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.